Okay. We have like a minute or two before we can start, but are there any questions? Before.
What's a raspberry bar?
You have to come and find out. And that won't be available on the web page. So that's all I can say. Okay, so I actually closed homework 4 and made it due. It's going to be due on 11/14. So it has problems up until, I guess, the first order predicate calculus theorem proving. Okay. And then there may be a homework 5, which essentially will include everything from now to the end of the semester. As to when it will be due, etc., we just have to dynamically. I mean, I'll open a socket and start throwing the problems in, but clearly the deadline has to be taken into account with respect to the end of the semester. So that's the last homework, if at all. So this one will definitely be there. Yes?
Is there going to be another project after the one that's currently listed?
Well, if you get done with this, yes.
So if we slack off?
Yeah. Yeah. If you slack off, yeah, you don't have to do anything. That's... I basically might, we could do a bunch of things. I mean, if this project gets done, did I actually provide a deadline for this project yet?
Not yet.
Ah, so I should actually provide a deadline. So I could make it due before Thanksgiving. or I could make it due on the day of Thanksgiving, whichever. So I normally, I guess, the way it is I will actually try to make it due before Thanksgiving, and we'll see how it's going, okay? And if people are having major trouble and they're not completing, then, if it is after Thanksgiving, then there is no other project. I think anyway, there's not too much time for a full-fledged project after this one. There may be small mini projects that might be just slipped into the homework. Like, for example, you might run a planner on some problems. You don't do any coding, things like that. You know, that might be there. Okay. Then actually, you could have a learning project too, but then, you know, we never have time for it because I'm doing the learning at the end, which I'm not particularly unhappy about because there are like 10,000 courses teaching you about machine learning right now. So I don't think I need to do one more separate thing on that. The bunch of other things that we do here, you don't get it in other courses, so you may as well learn it here. Okay. I will give a deadline for project 4. I won't commit to not having any projects after that. But, you know, if people are having trouble completing it. This does actually, I mean, normally people do have, it's a coding project, and people do get into some trouble, depending on. But they're also nice extra credit portions, so if you get done, you can do the extra credit portions anyway. So, including the stuff that we're doing today, which is doing planning as situation calculus theorem proving, can be done within the context of a prologue theorem prover. So that's one of the extra credit portions. Other questions? So the other main thing is on Friday, we at the same time in the same room. So basically 10:40 to 11:55, we'll have the makeup class. Like I said, the point is that since there is no class on Monday, you will have all the way up to Wednesday, if you actually miss it, you know, all the way up to Wednesday to make up for it by looking at the slides and so on. Okay? And then I also found out that the final exam actually has a schedule now. I mean, as you probably have realized, we never had a final exam schedule for this course. That's because I believe this timing is not standard timing. I don't know why. But now we have a final exam schedule, which is 12:10 from 12:20 to 2:10 p.m. That is, if we have an in-class exam, that's the only time it will be held. So that's for sure. Okay. So if there's going to be an in-class exam, that's the time. Okay. So
might be taken.
If it is a take home, then all bets are off, you know. So obviously you don't have to be sitting there. But you know, if it's in class, then that's the time.
Would we have to turn it in at that comment, or would it be?
I don't know. I have to make up my mind. Yeah. See, actually I think 12:10 is already a Monday, and then by Tuesday or Thursday, Wednesday of that week, all the exams are supposed to get over. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Okay. So what I am going to do today is sort of start from the logic, that the first order propositional logic, theorem proving. And then the first part of today's lecture is how you could do planning using first order logic. Okay. Part of the reason is actually you can see this part of the discussion either as how can I take first order logic and add syntactic sugar to it such that it will, for example, deal with time as if it is a special entity. Okay. In fact, the part of the discussion for this comes in, it comes from 10.3. So if you haven't looked at it up already, from section 10.3 of the textbook is where the situation calculus is coming. And the entire chapter 10 is really about how to take the mechanism of the basic infrastructure of first order logic and start modeling things like time, change, space, you know, any fun thing that you want to do. Okay, so you can look at this part of the lecture either as, given that I have first order logic, can I represent interesting things in it? One interesting thing here being change and time. Okay, we can also see this as essentially a way of doing planning, and then having looked at this way of doing planning, we look at a different way of doing planning after this, okay, because of some computational issues of doing it this way. Okay, so what I want to do is essentially some sort of a representation where I can talk about actions and change. Okay. So now, until now in first order logic, when we said any predicate P of X, Y, we did not make any commitment as to whether, you know, so for example, we never made any commitment as to if I said for all X, P of X implies Q of X, we didn't quite make any commitment as to whether this and this are in the same time instant or in different time instants, no such thing, okay? It could be in the same time instant, it could be in different time instant, okay? So we were essentially unaware of time, unaware of change, okay? What we're going to do now is to talk about actions, and in fact, this is something that part of the reason we gotten into this entire intelligent agents, right? So you want to be able to do an action, given some state of the world, you want to do an action, and you get a new state of the world F dash. Okay, and you want to write something about what you know about state of the world S, and then you do action and you want to talk about what will be true after the action. Okay, now time comes into the picture at the minimum because this is time T0, this is time T1. All we know is that T1 is greater than T0. It could be 15 units greater, it could be 2.5 units greater. The minimum way we will look at it right now is actions are instantaneous, and then there is a before the action world and after the action world. And you want to be able to talk about what's true in before the action, what is definitely going to be true after the action. Okay? And if you can represent that, you are in essence starting to talk about time. There's much more you can do about time. For example, you can actually talk about how long did the action take. In fact, most normal real world actions they don't get done instantaneously. So for example, if I'm at home and I walk to school, I will be at school. Now the point is, it takes a whole bunch of time to walk to school. So what is happening to my position while I am walking? You know, in fact, the way we are looking at this is, we'll ignore the duration. Before the action, I was at home. After the action, I will be at school. In between, what's happening? Undefined. I'm not going to talk about it. Okay, so we can go further from this and start talking about the durations of the actions and all that fun stuff, But for now, let's just think of simple instantaneous action models. Okay? And so the question, of course, is what can you do to talk about these instants in situation, in first order logic? Okay? So what we do for that is we consider a special case of first order logic called situation calculus. Okay? It's basically first order logic. Okay? But it has some extra things. So essentially, it's like a dialect of first order logic, where we essentially have certain special terms and certain special functions. Okay? So here is the deal. Situation calculus is a special class of first order predicate calculus. So just before you go look at this, let's first look at this. So here is the kind of thing I want to write. I want to say that for all x, for all blocks, this is the simple blocks world. Okay, for now let's assume that we are interested in talking about change in blocks world. There are named blocks and you can do actions. Okay, you can do, for example, there is a robot hand, it can pick up a block and put it down on the table or stack it on top of another block. Okay, that's the simple blocks world that I'm talking about. Okay, and there may be some initial configuration of the blocks in the world, and you want to do some actions to get to a new configuration of the block. The simple problem. Okay, so I might want to be able to write things like this. What I'm saying in this case is if the property holding is true for a block X in a situation F, then the property on table would be true for that same block in a situation that results from doing the action putting down of X in the situation F. Okay? So all I'm now, this basically explains, this gives me a way of talking about what's true before put down action and after put down action. If this were true before put down action, then this will be true after put down action. And the way I'm able to talk about after put down is obviously a special function called result, okay, which takes the name of the action and the situation, and this function gives out a situation. That's my representation. Okay? And since it's a function, obviously, one clear thing at this point is can you use this to represent non-deterministic action? What's a non-deterministic action? This is a deterministic action. When you apply it in a state, it gives you another state, a single state. A stochastic or a non-deterministic action, what does it do? If you do it in a state, you can get into multiple possible states. Because I'm thinking of a result function, in a sense, I'm making the commitment here at this point that I'm only modeling deterministic action, at least at this rate. Okay? So I am basically doing this action in this situation, I'll get a new situation in which on table would be true. Okay? This is the kind of thing I want to be able to write. Now, this is a simple first order logic axiom. If I didn't tell you anything, this is a first order logic axiom. There's nothing particularly new about this, right? There is a quantification, there's an implication, this is a predicate of terms, and this is a term. Yes?
Why is it that
the
function has to be deterministic?
What?
Why does it have to be deterministic?
Because a function, normally the way you define a function is function takes a value and gives a value back. So you can, if I define result to represent, no, give back set of situations, then it's fine. No. All I'm saying is, in this particular case, I am making the commitment that result of an action to a situation will be a situation. In which case, then again, so in doing this, in essence, I'm saying that for all the properties of the world, now I essentially represent them, I mean, I index them with the situation in which that property holds. It's not enough to just say A is on B. You have to say A is on B in a situation S. and C is on D in a situation F dash. Okay, it's the situations which have some ordering relations, temporal ordering relation. One situation comes before another situation. And the way you transform situations in this scenario, the way we are looking at it, is by doing actions. Okay, so that's, and then this is a simple first order logic axiom. Now you can also have, so one interesting thing about this axiom is it is talking about two different situations. On this side is talking about F, and this side is talking about F dash, which is result of putting down X in F. Okay, but I can also write axioms of the following form, which is just axioms that hold in a given situation. Okay, so for example, what this says is for all X, Y, and F, okay, if it is not the case that X is on top of Y in situation F, okay, that means there is no X on top of Y in situation S, okay, then Y is clear. That's my definition of clearness of the block. If there's nobody on top of me, then I'm clear. Okay? And similarly, I am using these two to define a notion of aboveness. A block is above another block if it's on top of it, but above is also transitive closure of on. If you are above X, and X is above Y, then, I'm sorry, if you are above Z, if Y is above Z and X is above Y, then X is above Z. Onness doesn't work that way, right? So I'm actually making a new property called aboveness, and I wrote the theory of aboveness in this situation. In this, yes, sir. What?
The for all sign.
No, if I don't say anything, it's for the entire thing.
For the entire thing?
Yes.
So, is it still true?
Which one?
I mean, for the first one, let's say, if some, yes.
Okay, let me look at it. So this one, right? So, all I'm saying is, for all X,
I think it should be for the
No, you need to have a for all over F anyway, on this side too. And you also need to have for every Y, if you can prove that there is no X on top of it in a given situation, then it's clear in that situation. That's what I'm saying. Okay? You can start putting scopes, but if I didn't say anything, my implicit scope is for the entire sentence. Okay, so I can write these things. And in writing these, what is the commitment I made? I essentially made the following commitments. Extra commitment. Okay, I now have special terms called situations. I know there are all sorts of constants. Normally we had lots and lots of constants, right? Now we have situational constants and situational variables. So these are type theory now. So suddenly everything else has no type, except there is a type called situations. There are constants of type situations, and there are variables of type situations. Okay, now, and the situations are always appearing in special places in the context of properties. So for each property now has an extra argument, an extra term, and that's the situational term. Okay? And then I also have special terms called action terms. And action terms talk about actions that I can do. And then I have a special function called result function, which takes an action, applies it to a situation, and gets me a new situation. Now again, in writing FOPC axioms, right, all you need to do is be consistent. You could have made up whatever you wanted. Okay, so all I'm saying is, in situation calculus, these are the commitments I make, and then I am consistent in using them. Okay, in doing so, I can essentially represent time and change to a pretty good degree. Okay, now the advantage of writing it this way is now, if I want to do planning, I can essentially ask, you know, I have a theorem prover for solving these kinds of, I mean, if I have a database of these kinds of axioms, and if I have a planning problem, what is a planning problem? I can ask, given what I know, is there a situation where certain properties will hold? Okay? And the theorem prover will have to prove, yes, there is a situation like that, or no, there is no situation. In fact, if there is such a situation, it will give you a proof showing that such a situation exists. And on top of it, if the theorem, the proof happens to be constructive, then you would know actually how that situation occurred. That situation would have been result of doing some action in the first situation and that and doing a second action in the second situation and so on. Okay? So from the theorem proof itself, you can extract the plan back. Okay? All I'm trying to say is, I have a theorem prover, it's not doing anything, it now can do planning. Okay? By just representing planning problem in first order logic, it can now do planning. Right? That's the point. Questions on this stuff? Yes?
You said it has to be constructive proof without existential.
That's a good problem. I mean, most of the time you will get constructive proofs. As I said in the end of last class, you can essentially get existential proofs, you know, when you are, for example, doing conformant planning in this kind of a scenario. In the bomb in the toilet problem, it's very easy to say, yes, there is a situation where you are safe, and you wouldn't know what that situation is. Essentially, you'll say it's either this or this. Okay. Of course, you can always say on top of that, that means that you do both of them, you'll get the, you know, you'll get to the safe situation. But there is a general issue of how do you force the theorem prover to give constructive proofs. Okay. But for most of our scenarios, in fact, remember the long, long back we were talking about the types of environments, right? Deterministic versus stochastic, dynamic versus static, fully observable versus partially observable. What am I really looking at here? Deterministic, because the actions have actually actions working on a situation give a unique situation back. And static, because I said the only way a situation will change is if I do an action. So it's static. And fully observable, because I know in a sense, well, the observability issue is whether a property is true in a situation or not is the issue. And I haven't actually said anything about non-observability until now. So in essence, I'm looking at the simplest kind of domain, simplest kind of environment, deterministic, static, fully observable. Okay? Now, let's see, what happened to my middle slide?
My
what?
Can you build this on top of just a normal credit and calculus theorem prover, or do you have to change to add the result function?
You know, adding a function is, it's not that you're changing anything. I mean, the first order logic essentially had the ability, I mean, you could have defined any functions, you just start using them. Yeah. No, but the point is, again, type theory, the ability of simulating type theory exists in first order logic. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you didn't care about it, all I needed is, if I didn't like to talk about types, then I would make up a new relation called situation P. Okay? And it only holds to be true for situational arguments. Okay, then I could have just said, for all x as if s is the situation and everything else. So type theory is not hard to do. Basically, you just add an extra, you basically throw in the predicates that are needed. The interesting thing about built-in type theory is that somebody else is already making sure that this is implicitly added in. Keep quiet, I mean, in terms of the efficiency issues, because we have all sorts of efficiency issues that we will talk about in a minute. Okay? Don't start writing the program yet. Okay? The question is, can we model the world right now? Okay? So anyway, I forgot, I'm missing a slide, I'll add it back in a minute, next time. But now here is the interesting thing. So right, I have this statement, right? For all XS, holding XS implies on table X, result put down XS. Okay, and this statement is already there. And suppose I happen to know that in situation S0, holding A is true in situation S0. S0 is a constant. I want to know, will there be a situation S such that on table A is true in that situation? That's my question. That's a very simple planning problem. Really, really simple planning problem. Okay? And since I already have this theorem, I mean this axiom as part of my domain, and I have this, I can do first order theorem proving. Right? Let's do it, because actually we only mentioned it last time. So let's do, so I have for all x as holding x as implies on table x result of doing put down x in situation S. Okay? That was one sentence, and I have this fact, and my query is this. Right? So if I'm doing resolution theorem proving, what would this become? This will become not holding x s are on table x result of holding put down, doing put down x in situation S. I'm just doing the resolution theorem proving. It's just another example we're doing right now. Okay? And this is just holding A as 0. And as far as my theorem is concerned, I have to negate the theorem. If I negate the theorem, this will become for all S not on table AS. To prove that there is such a situation, I try to prove the opposite of it. Okay? And all this is saying is, no, there is no situation in the world where A would ever be on table A, on table. Okay? Now if I throw this in here, not on table AS. Okay? And what can I do? What can I do resolution in this case? This and this can be resolved. Right? Let's make all the variables of different names. Let's call this a dash. Okay? You can always, the quantified variables, normally to avoid any confusion, you should standardize the variables apart. You know, for every quantification, have a new name for the variable. Okay? So now, to make this and this, can these to be unified? Can you unify on table AF dash with on table X result of put down X S? Yes. Okay? All you need to do is F dash is set to result of put down X S, and in fact X itself is set to A. So in fact I should make it simpler, write it A. This is just unification. You understand this unification. When I do this, this and this will become equal. So I cancel that out and I get this down, which will be not holding A F dash. No, not holding A S dash, right? No. Okay, you want, yeah, not holding A S, that's it. Because S dash is set to this. S remains the same as before. Not holding A S. Now, this can now be unified with this. And if you set S equal to capital S 0, which is a constant, then this will be an empty card. So I essentially proved that it is true that there exists a situation where A is on table. When the proof went through, now I can ask, what is that situation? Okay? What I need is, what is F dash bound to? F dash is bound to result of put down A in S, where S itself is bound to original situation S0. Right? So what I really did is the binding was that in the situation, f dash is basically finally bound to result of putting down A in situation F0. And that's the specific situation in which the property that you're looking for holds. And because now, and this also gives you a construction, right? Because it's now telling you how to produce such an F dash. Do this action in the original situation, and you get this. Now, why did I go through this? All I'm trying to do is convince you that it's really theorem proving. You know, I mean, this may have looked kind of new to you only because you did first order logic theorem proving last class. But if all you do in your life is first order logic theorem proving, if you are a theorem prover, it's just one more theorem proving example. Okay, and the end of the theorem proving, you know the plan. Okay, that's the point. Okay? Any questions? Yes.
So if there are more than one situation possible for which this is true, it would only tell you one of them?
No. There are multiple proofs, that means.
Okay.
There are multiple proofs, and each proof would correspond to a way of a plan. This is true for, in general, search too, right? Again, what's happening is there are multiple ways of producing a situation where the property that you require is true. All I need to do is, the question I asked is, does there exist a situation? And the resolution definition says, no, there doesn't exist a situation. And to disprove that, you just have to show a situation where it holds. Okay, and multiple proofs correspond to multiple plans. That's a very good point. Okay, that's fine. So the plan essentially is this mapping. Start from S0, do put down A, and you'll get the situation where the property you want is true. So if you have multiple steps, what would it look like? It might be, if it was a larger plan, it would have looked like this. F dash is result of result of result of result of doing A1 in F0 and, so I'm sorry, you have to write it in. Okay. So do result of doing A1 in F0, in that do A2, and in that do A3. That basically means the plan is A1 followed by A2 followed by A3. Okay? That's basically what the theorem prover would do. Yes, sir? What? Yeah, but I didn't ask whether or not that's the case. Just keep that thought to yourself. But all I asked at this point is there a situation where A is on table F? And I said, yeah, such a situation can be produced. If you were to put it down, you would produce it. Okay. Now, here is my question then. If this is the case, do we need to even talk about planning separately? It looks like planning is just a special case of theorem proving, which is sort of true. Okay. Now, but consider the following scenario. In the same exact previous problem, okay, now you have two blocks. Apart from block A, you also have block B. B is sitting on the table minding its own business. Okay? And what I want to get, and it was clear. Okay? What I want to now do is to get it to a situation where both A is on table and B is on table. So leave B as it was before and just put A on table. Most of you think, yeah, it was the same problem as before, right? It's the same problem as before. What is A, B got to do with anything? You know, B was just hanging around there, and you know, you put down A is on table, B is already on table, so everything is fine and dandy. Will your theorem prover know this? If you try to do the theorem proving, you will get stuck trying to prove that in the new situation, B is still on table. Nobody is telling you that after you put down A, B is still on table. This is sort of similar to your question. What happened to the, you know, all I said was in the, you know, with respect to this particular axiom here. All I said was, if you do put down action, a certain property will definitely hold. I didn't say that others won't hold, right? I didn't say anything about all the other properties of the world. What? Yeah, that was my point. That's exactly what we'll be talking about. So the advantage of this is you can specify a situation just by telling what I know about that situation. I don't have to say more or less than what I want to say. Now the problem, of course, is the poor theorem prover would say, look, you didn't tell me anything about B not changing its place when you just put A on the table. Okay? This is a problem. The reason you thought it wasn't a problem is because you know how the world works, and you said, well, if you put A on table, why would that affect B? But that's something that you know, and it wasn't written anywhere in my axioms. Right? There's nothing said in the axioms. So all I'll do, that can be done. All we'll do now is we'll just throw in an axiom saying that anything which was clear before will still continue to be clear when you put A on table. And anything which was on table before will still continue to be on table when you put A on table. And then that will make sure that the theorem prover will go. Right? But does that make sense? What did I just get myself into? I'm not only talking about what changes because of an action, I'm also now pushed to talk about what doesn't change because of an action. In any rich enough world, there are a gazillion million things that hopefully don't change because of an action, unless the action is bomb the universe, right? An action changes a small set of the properties of the world and leaves everything else unchanged. Okay, what you would like to do is some sort of a default assumption, saying if I didn't tell you it changes, if I didn't tell you that it changes, then it didn't change. But if you want to do such default reasoning, you can't do it in first order logic, because first order logic is monotonic. It's sort of like saying, if I didn't tell you that the bird is an abnormal bird, assume that it flies. Okay? So the problem is, unless you can push the default reasoning into first order logic, which will make it into non-monotonic logic, you are stuck with having to write not only what changes because of an action, but also what doesn't change because of an action. What is much worse is not only do you have to write what all doesn't change, but for each of those axioms, you need to push them through the theorem prover, saying, yeah, everything else remains the same. So suppose I have 10,000 properties mentioned in the initial state. The goal state says, keep one of those properties should be changed, rest of the 9,999 remain the same. Now the theorem proof is going to be at least 10,000 deep. It has some number of levels just to prove that the property that you wanted to change did change. And having from there onwards, for every one of the properties that didn't change, it has to use the appropriate axiom to say it did not change. This kills search. If you increase the depth of search, theorem proving is search, remember that? Theorem proving is search, right? Because, you know, it's always easy to show one proof, but your normal theorem prover tries all sorts of proofs, most of which don't go anywhere. The deeper the proof, the much larger the search, and exponentially larger the search. Okay? So there are like two computational problems that we are talking about here. One is that you actually have to write a whole bunch of things about properties of the world that don't change. It seems like painful, but you shouldn't actually complain, because what it allows you is to talk about all kinds of situations. So if you want to talk about a crazy kind of a put down axiom, which sometimes, put down action, which most of the time leaves other blocks unchanged, except on the full moon days when it changes some of the blocks other than A. You can easily write that in this case. Okay, but to get that level of expressiveness, you would then wind up paying huge penalty for solving simple problems. That's the point. Okay? To make this, you put in some sort of numbers. If you have k properties, k predicates, and m actions, then you would need to write k times m frame axiom. A frame axiom essentially says this property doesn't change when you do this action. You know, on the order of k times m frame axioms. You can reduce this number of frame axioms from k times m to just k if you want. And the idea there would be to talk about something called a successor state axiom, which takes a property and says for every property, that property will not change unless you wound up doing one of these three actions. Okay, so on the left hand side of the axiom there will be a disjunction. Okay, suppose there are two different ways in which you can put down at the block onto the table. One is to gently put it down, other is to shoot it down onto the table. Okay, so then this act, the successor state axiom will say, if you have holding XS, it would be holding XS in the next situation unless you wind up doing either put down of X or shoot down of X. Okay, so that sort of can reduce the number of frame axioms into what's called the number of successor state axioms, which is only one for each property. All of these are again discussed in the textbook. Go back and look at it. Okay, but that does not change the other problem I talked about. The real main problem, computational problem of the frame axioms, is if you have the frame axioms, you have to use them. You actually, for each property that didn't change, your theorem prover has to prove to itself that it didn't change. That's an extra depth to the theorem. Depth is bad for search because it exponentially increases the complexity. Okay, so what, having realized that planning can be easily formulated and modeled as infrastructure logic, we make two observations in this slide. One is you really need default logic. First order logic is not really good. It can be done, but unless you are able to make default axioms, which we didn't talk about here at all, okay, you're stuck with having to write all these successor state axioms and having to use them. So what I would do next is to say, let me put into words a sort of a closed world assumption about effects of an action. And I will say, not only that, here in this case I said this is an effect, right? In some sense what I'm trying to say is, what I would like to say is, these are the only effects. If I didn't say something is an effect, it didn't change. That's what you had in the back of your head. That's why you are wondering why theorem prover took so much longer. Okay, and we will essentially write a representation which makes this assumption upfront, which says unless something has been shown to be an effect, it's not an effect. It's a compiled closed world assumption. Okay, and that compiled closed world assumption is made by what's called a STRIPS language, a STRIPS assumption, and we'll look at that in a minute. Okay, yes sir. What?
You need to write two rules with the same head for every disjunction you want as a part of that rule.
I don't understand the question.
Like if you had, it's true that you're flying if you're in a plane or you are a bird.
Yeah.
Do you have to write flying plane?
You can have disjunction on either side of the implication. That's fine.
Is that true of Horn clauses?
No, these would not be Horn clauses. In fact, first-order theorem proving doesn't care whether you're a Horn clauses or not. Successor state axioms are not Horn anymore. Okay? In fact, you can do situation calculus-based theorem proving in your prologue interpreter, except it will miss some of the proofs because it cannot write non-Horn clauses. So you'll miss some of the proofs. In some cases, you can solve the problem. Some cases, you can't. Okay? In particular, that simple case, you will be able to solve the problem. Okay? Anyway, one interesting thing in talking about this is this frame axiom, having to write frame axioms. Okay, and even though this is a bit of a diversion, I want to mention something called sexishness, and that cute digger wasp. Okay, and let me tell you the story of this little digger wasp. What it does, you know, you can read this. It's been known that what a digger wasp does is, it, when it's about to lay eggs, right, it first goes and kills a cricket. Okay, but it doesn't completely kill it. It just injects little enough amount of poison such that it's kind of not fully dead, but sort of, you know, put in sort of an hibernation kind of scenario. And then leaves this and takes this cricket, drags it to its little burrow. We first, it, you know, digs a burrow, drags it, puts it outside of the burrow, goes inside, lays the eggs, okay, and disappears. Now when the eggs hatch, they come out, they have a nice, basically preheated cricket waiting for them. It's not dead, it's not spoiled cricket. It's a cricket which has just been put in hibernation, ready for these eggs, you know, the hatched eggs to eat. Okay, if you don't call this intelligence, what do you call intelligence, right? I mean, this must be, digger wasp must be, you know, able to do masters and, you know, bachelor's in computer science with a little extra training. Okay, people have seen this and people are very impressed with how intelligent this wasp is. Okay, now the only problem is, people have also seen that there is a determinism to its actions. Okay, it's a built-in determinism. It does this very beautiful procedure, but if you were to, when it actually puts the cricket outside the burrow and goes in to lay the eggs, if you move the cricket a little, like 3 millimeters, it actually realizes that you moved it. Not 3 millimeters, maybe some amount. Okay, so it now realizes that cricket has been moved. That means some action has been done. It basically assumes anything can happen now. Okay, so it says, let me redo the whole thing again. So it will go back, put the cricket in the right position, go back into the burrow, make sure that everything is right, come back outside, etc. And if you do it again, move, it will do this again. And apparently somebody actually, who had no time on his hands, and I don't know who is more intelligent in this case, this guy actually did it 40 times with this wasp. And in 40 times it kept doing this. Okay? And this is called sexishness, and in fact people have said that apparently intelligent behavior sometimes may not be intelligent. Now again, this is a total verbal minefield, because I don't know what the heck is intelligence. Okay, but we might be thinking until up to here that this guy is the most intelligent wasp out there, and then here is that's not okay, because there's a determinism thrown in. But if you're thinking of sexishness, in fact the poor sexish, in fact it's the reason it's called sexishness is its name. This wasp's name is Sex Ignominious or something like that. Okay, so they made up this whole thing called sexishness, which is apparently intelligent behavior, which is essentially repetitive, which is sort of, you know, redoing some particular procedure. And the only thing that this poor guy is missing in some sense is frame axioms. Right? It assumes that everything can potentially change, so let's not take any chances. I mean, you could probably say, if you want, if it only did it 3-4 times, you could say it's just a concerned mother, you know. But when you start doing it 40 times, it's not just concerned mother, it's brain dead mother, you know. But interesting point to think about, okay. Anyway, so, but I got here because we wanted to do theorem proving, planning by theorem proving, okay. And then we could do it as theorem proving, except you have to write these frame axioms, and then you have to use them. Okay, the only way you can get out of this in two different ways. One is, you need to do default logic, which is actually, the problem with that is there are no efficient theorem provers for default logic. Okay, but you can learn all about it by taking a course with Chitta. Okay, the other is to say, look, to the extent I mostly can be forced to write whatever changes, I can compile the closed world assumption into the language, into the representation language. And so now, I'll essentially, the theorem prover or the reasoner can essentially say, unless something has been said to change, it did not change. Okay? That's called the Stripp's assumption. Okay? It looks like a very simple, reasonable assumption, but we'll see that what it means ultimately is any of these things which make computation easy make somebody else's life hard. Okay? So, really, I would love to basically be able to say that, you know, writing the world in these sort of default logic or first order logic axioms is easier for the guy who's writing about the domain. Because they can just say what they want to say and nothing more and nothing less. Whereas that will make the computational theorem proving hard, computational aspects harder. Whereas if you do it this way, in Stripp's assumption, the writer of the domain has to introduce everything that changes in the description of the action. Nothing is left to chance. But then since they spent all that time, the reasoner can use that guarantee and be much faster. Okay? So now I will look at a new representation for blocks world, the same blocks world, where essentially I am, you know, making this assumption. And then I do some extra syntax. Essentially, I'll say that for each action, I have a bunch of preconditions, which are properties that must hold before that action, and bunch of effects, which are the only properties that changed because of this action. And if a property is not mentioned in the effects, then it did not change. Whatever it was before the action, it will remain the same after the action. Okay? Now, while looking at this, you can either think of these as properties, you know, predicates with arguments, or you can also think of them as just state variables. Both are fine. Okay? When you come here from the first order logic slides, it's easiest to think of these essentially as properties. Okay? But you can also think of them as essentially Boolean state variables. Okay, and all I'm saying is a state is represented in terms of a set of Boolean state variables and their truth-falsity values. An action can be done in a state if certain state variables have certain values already in that state, in which case it changes the values of some of the state variables and leaves the other state variables unchanged. Okay, because I can make this assumption, what I would do, and I'll come back to these slides again in a minute, but what I would wind up doing is if I have an entire state and I do an action, I check before doing an action whether its preconditions are holding in the state. If it says certain state variables must have certain action values, I check whether those hold. If so, I can do the action. And then the new state essentially is written by writing all the effects of the action, which are the new values of the state variables. And then any state variable that didn't get mentioned in that, I just copy it over from the previous state. So now, essentially, I'm doing algebra over states. Right? The actions doctor the states. And they say, these pieces change, everything else remains the same. Okay? And the reason you could do this is because of this assumption. You're making the assumption that the only things that would change because of an action are the ones that are explicitly mentioned in the effect. Okay? Now, just a second. So what do you lose because of this? What you lose because of this is that you must write explicitly everything. Okay, for example, you don't get to say, come on, I already told you nothing is on top of A. Why do I have to say A is clear? Can't you be somewhat more intelligent and just realize that? You don't get to say that. Because if you do that, essentially, you are not mentioning every property that changes or every property that didn't get affected. That gets affected, okay? So you don't get to talk about derived effects. You have to write every effect, every property that changes, whether it changes primarily or as a consequence of the things that changed. Okay? Whereas in the situation calculus representation, I get to say that the essential effect of this action is that, you know, the earth starts moving. And then from that you can derive a whole bunch of things. Earth starts moving, buildings will fall down, fires will start, fire engines will be going around. All those are derived effects. But in strips, you have to write every one of them, because that's the only way you can be complete for the action description. Okay? So whose life became hard? The guy who wrote the domain. We don't care about them. You know, in particular, if you also write the domain and you also write the computer program, then you just essentially are writing the domain in such a way that it would be efficiently handleable by the search underneath. I believe this is not all that different from what companies make you do once you graduate and go to work for them. Okay? Because, as I say, a very loose analogy is first order situation calculus models is like writing programs in very high level language. But then, you know, maybe somebody has to optimize them. Okay? But to the extent I am paying for your time, I would much rather say, hey, write it in assembly language. You know, because then there's no question of optimization. You know, you did everything. Okay? So to some extent, the model, in fact, state variable model is sort of in between. It turns out that situation calculus is kind of Lisp. This is a very bad analogy and a very loose analogy. State variable models can be thought of as C, and there is even lower level model of change, which essentially says that an action, really, if you think in terms of states which are opaque, so I would not even talk about how states are defined. It's like go back all the way to problem solving agent. Okay? I'll just say there are states S1 to S1000. Those are the states. I don't know what's different about them. What is, you know, S1 is just as different from S2 as it is from S1000. Okay? And then an action essentially is a function which takes a state and gives a new state. So every action can be written as this matrix. Okay? So in fact, so for example, this is S15, and I will say if you do the action in S15, I will get to S250. So I'll put a 1 there. Everywhere else I'll put zeros. Okay? And then similarly, if I were to do action in S3, I will get to S105. So I will put a 1 here, everywhere else 0. So I can write actions completely in terms of these transition matrices. Okay? And so in that case, all actions have the same size. Their size is S by S matrix, which is very bad, because if you notice, what happens is if you have essentially n Boolean state variables, then the number of states would be 2 power n. And you are talking about matrices of size 2 power n by 2 power n. That's the lowest level. Okay? And then you make some, you go higher level by state variable model, because you're actually talking about what makes a state is these n variables and their values. And so rather than talk about actions in terms of these big matrices, I will tell you what values should the state variables have before and what values would they have after. Okay? Yes?
If you have pattern matching built into theorem prover to match the variables, why not just use the same mechanism to match rules and situations?
What would that buy us?
Well, if you could match situations and see what's different between them.
No, the problem is there is, in fact, the situation calculus, the advantage, I mean, both its advantage and disadvantage are the same, which is I can make up a situation S7 and say a few things about it. Now the problem is, did I say everything? Am I going to say more? You don't know. And in fact, the representation allows you to partially specify situation. Okay, what is true in the situation? Whereas the representation that we are doing here, essentially, I start with an initial state, which is a complete state of the world, where you tell me exactly what are the values of all the properties, or what are the values of all the state variables. And then an action applied to a complete state leads to a complete state. So you always know exactly where you are. Okay? And in fact, it also makes the commitment about full observability clear. Because if you don't know the initial state completely, that means if you don't know some of the properties of the initial state, it doesn't make a huge big difference in the situation calculus. Because you would say S0 is the initial situation, and I get to say either P is true or Q is true in the initial situation. I can say that. Whereas in this approach, I don't get to do that because I have a state where entire state is completely specified in terms of the state variable values. Okay? And so then I would be searching in the space of complete state, where these are factored states. They are not black boxes in terms of numbered states, but these are factored states where each state is derived from n variables having certain, you know, true false values. Okay? Anyway, let's look at this particular guy. So I am basically assuming in this case that the initial state, so for the simple case where I'm assuming complete initial state, that means complete observability, then the initial state is completely known. All the properties are known. Okay? So if I have a complete state, then since all properties are known, I can just essentially assume that I can just take a convention and say, I will write only the things that are true, and everything else by definition is false. You don't get to do that when you only know some of the things in the state. Because then when you don't say something about a property, do you mean that you don't know about that property, or do you mean that you know that it is negative? Okay, but for complete states, I can just write what is true and leave everything else, because everything else is by definition false. Okay, the actions themselves. So for example, the holding, the put down X action requires that in the previous state, the holding is true. And in the next state, X would be on table, hand would be empty, X would be clear, and X would not be held. This is that guy's question. I'm actually, in the previous case, I never told you whether, if you put it on table, whether holding is true or not in the situation calculus. But here I have to say it. It looks as if, you know, I'm basically requiring very specific representation, but that's the price I pay for having the inference easy. Okay, and so in this case, I have to say not holding X, and I also have to say clear X because there's nothing on top of it. And once I give this, then these are the only variables that change. So if I start with a big state and holding A is true in that state, then I know that on table A would be true in the new state, hand empty will be true in the new state, clear A would be true in the new state, not holding A would be true in the new state, and everything else that was true in the previous state is just copied over. Yes?
Is there any means of model checking this? I mean, like, let's say you wrote your effect, but you somehow forgot an effect, and ultimately you can lead to a situation where you can't do anything.
Yeah, that's a problem. So how do you, this is verification of models. It's like you write a program. Is there a way of checking whether your program was right to begin with or not? Software verification is a much harder problem, but model verification is a sort of a version of that. How do you actually figure this out? When something is not solvable, is it because it actually can't be solved, or is it because you didn't pay enough money to the guy who wrote the domain and so he or she slept through and forgot a couple of effects? That's a very good question. Okay, and to the extent you don't count the effort in writing the domains or the software, there's more increased chance that verification would be harder. I mean, to the argument in favor of higher level languages is that the programs can be verified more easily. And then there is a sort of a deterministic compilation, and so the compilation is verified to be correct, and the program is verified at a higher level to be correct, and so the entire thing is correct. Whereas if you wrote the whole thing in assembly language, then the question is, how long did you take to prove to yourself that it's correct? Okay? It's a very good point, and there's no way out of it. The more you take something like this description, I mean, it's true for any model, whether it's higher level or lower level. But the chance that you could be wrong I mean, you could have made a mistake in specifying the model is higher if you are forced to work in, you know, in languages that make you be over specific, for example, by saying things like not holding X or by, you know, doing assembly language. Okay. Yes. I said higher level language, that's the point. First order situation calculus is sort of like Lisp. In fact, the default logic would be even higher than Lisp. Okay. Anyway, let's not talk about the analogy as much. I mean, you can keep that in mind and we can talk about it offline. But I'm essentially trying to say that the reason I came here is because first I tried to do planning in first order logic itself, but there were some problems. There's nothing wrong in terms of modeling. You can model the problem. And you can actually solve the problems, but the size of the problems you can solve is limited because of the expressivity of the language. Because the language allows you to say only things partially about situations, you have to write all these extra axioms and use them to get to the state that you need and to actually compute the plan. So then you come to this scenario where you write everything, you know, explicitly. And then it becomes a search. It becomes a simple search. Okay? So here are other actions. So pick up is similar to put down, stack, unstack. Okay? So let's just look at one of these. Unstack XY, by definition, what I'm saying here is that to do unstack XY, the English description is X is on top of Y, and I need to be able to pick it up so that it's no longer on top of Y. So X is on top of Y, my hand should be empty so that I can pick it up, and it better be the case that X is clear. In which case, in the new state, I'm holding X, X is no longer clear, I don't get to say, I won't say anything about clearness of the block, I have to say what it is, okay? X is no longer clear, Y is clear because X has come out of Y, this is a classic derived effect, but you have to write it anyway. And then hand is no longer empty because I'm holding something. To the extent you don't mind writing this, and in fact one of the interesting things is people don't mind writing these kinds of descriptions for reasonably large size domains. Okay, this is essentially the way planning domains are specified now. And the advantage then is you can use the closed world assumption that's been compiled in to convert what you want to do into a simple search. Okay, so for example, let me consider the following problem. Okay, A is on table, B is on table, A is clear, B is clear, hand is empty. So only two blocks, and my hand is empty and the two blocks are on table. My goal is to have hand empty and B not clear. First, do you know how to solve this problem? To make B not clear and hand empty, you need to put A on top of B. And then your hand will still be empty and B is no longer clear. It's a funny, you know, it's just, you know, within the confines of this simple scenario, it's tricky enough problem. Okay? And now again, since there are conjuncts here, in normal situation calculus, you must have had to deal with frame axioms, saying something didn't change as well as something changed. Here, all I need to do is start with the initial state and just do my A star search. Okay, all that's different really is the child generator function can, I don't have to write a separate child generator function for each problem. I can write a generic child generator function which assumes that the states are in terms of state variables and can take a bunch of actions and which are represented in this kind of a format and write down the new states. So a single child generator function which can take all domains which are written in this form and then produce the new states when you apply an action to a state. Okay, and what does the child generator function do? An action A can be applied to state S if the preconditions are satisfied in the current state. Preconditions being satisfied means if you said certain state variables must have certain values, you check whether that's the case or not. If it's not, you don't get to do that action at all. If they are, then what I do is I will write down first all the effects, all the variables which are mentioned in the effects of the action first. These are all the ones that are mentioned in pickup A. After pickup A, A is being held, A is not clear, A is on, not on table, and hand is no longer empty. Having written these, then everything else is just copied over. Now, in this particular scenario, actually, it looks as if you wrote four things and then only copied two. But more generally, you write four things because of the effect and copy a million things from the previous state. If it's a rich enough scenario, in fact, if you just have 10 blocks in the previous state in some various configuration, you have to talk about the states of all those blocks. And most of them will just copy over except these guys. That's the advantage. Okay? And then similarly, if I do pick up B, you know, I get a new state like this. Now, the advantage now is I went from theorem proving to simple A star search. Okay? And how do I, what's my goal test? My goal test is if I, to the extent the goals are defined in terms of providing, requiring partial assignments that must be holding for state variables, goal test is in the state that I'm holding, in the state that I'm holding, is the, are the variables having the values that I'm expecting, they're expected to have. If so, you stop. If not, you continue generating more and more states. So the only difference between planning and search now, so it's like we are either trying to do planning, as we are always trying to be parasitical, which is not bad, okay, because we did some things already, right, search and theorem proving. We first tried to do planning as theorem proving, and that had some problems. Now we are doing planning as search, which has its own problems, you know, in terms of modeling, but, you know, it has, computationally, it's much more efficient. Okay, now that you're thinking of planning as search, you can ask all sorts of interesting questions, such as, what's the heuristic? Right? I mean, if you have a state, you have a whole bunch of actions that you can do. You have bunches of these states standing around saying, you know, expand me, which one are you going to expand to go to the goal state? Which is the one that's likely to lead you to the goal state faster? And in fact, when we come back on this particular topic, what we will talk about are the kind of relaxed heuristics, abstraction-based heuristics, that seem to make a huge difference for this class of problems, such that you can solve very large size, you know, hundreds of actions plans in under minutes. Okay, hundreds of actions means 100 depth, which is pretty bad for, you know, for search. Okay? One other thing I want to mention before, and then actually we'll come back to it when I come back next class, is one of the advantages of having these actions specified in this factored form rather than in this form. If you specify the actions in the factored form, which is what state variables should have certain values and what state variables will be guaranteed to have certain other values, okay, the search now doesn't have to be done starting from the initial state towards the goal state. You can start from the goal state and apply, consider applying the actions and say, if I am in this state and the last action I did was put down A, what else must I do before this action? Such that if I have done those by here and I do this action, I'll be done. Okay? So in particular, I will say, look at this. So put down A, if put down A is the last action, okay, when you put A down, hand is already empty. So after this action, hand is already empty. So I don't any longer have to work on hand empty before this action. Okay. Now, not clear B is not given by put down A. So I still need to work on not clear B. But then I made a commitment to do this action here, which means all its preconditions must be worked on. Right? So what are its preconditions? For put down A, the preconditions is holding A. So I'm telling you for sure that if you want to be here, if you can get me here, then I'll get you from here to here by just doing put down A. Okay? This is a search in the backward direction. In a way, you can argue that this search can have much smaller branching factor, because there are large number of properties in the initial state, maybe only a few properties you care about in the goal state. Okay, and you would consider only those actions which at least do something useful. You wouldn't consider doing an action if it doesn't give either not clear B or hand empty. Why do it? If I give you a plan which has a last action that has no useful effect, then you can always remove that last action and you'll still have a plan. Right? So you can have a much more effective search going in the backward direction. The problem is, how do you know whether the sub-goals you set for yourself are actually reachable? How many of you have realized that this is impossible? Is it possible to have, in my little world, B not clear and A is being held? Remember, A and B are on the table, and I have an empty hand. Is it actually possible to have B not clear and holding A? No. If you couldn't realize it, your program probably didn't realize it. So this dead man or dead woman would lead to dead children who are dead on arrival, will have their dead grandchildren which are also dead on arrival, and you can work for a long time without making any progress. Okay? So there are advantages in terms of reduced branching factor, but there are also disadvantages in terms of realizing whether or not the set of sub-goals you are trying to achieve together are actually feasible. Are they consistent? This was not a problem in the forward direction, because in the forward direction, each state is a complete real-world state. Okay? In the backward direction, on the other hand, you essentially have some goal states that some sets of sub-goals that actually can't be made true, and you don't realize it, you'll be in trouble. So it turns out that while you can do forward as well as backward search, as to which is better, you still don't know, because they seem to have, both seem to have advantages as well as disadvantages. And the last thing that you can think of right now is, if I have n state variables, the number of complete states are how many? If there are n state variables, you know, if in doubt, whenever I say n, you should say 2 power n, right? That's the whole point of this class. If there are n state variables, the number of complete states are 2 power n. How many are the partial states? Because when you're going back, you don't talk about the complete state, you only talk about partial states. How many partial states are there? What? No, the partial states of this form, where all I am doing is I mention a variable and require it to be negative, I mention a variable and require it to be positive, or I don't mention the variable at all. 3 power n. That's the beauty. So when you do regression, you're searching in the space of 3 power n states. Whereas when you do progression, you're searching in the space of 2 power n states. So it's not surprising that regression can actually be worse sometimes. Okay? We'll stop here. When we come back and talk about planning again, we'll talk about how to derive effective heuristics for focusing this search, which will make you remember all the good stuff you learnt about heuristics in HR search.